The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Yuri Ziska. I'm the co-artistic director of the Wilma Theater, and it is my pleasure. Thank you. It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Before we begin, let me make a little announcement. Please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. And after the program, please join us upstairs in the lobby for the book signing. Tonight's guest is Wally Soyinka, a poet, playwright, novelist, and critic whose work reflects a wide cultural perspective and a deep commitment to social justice. Born in Nigeria, Mr. Soyinka was the first African to win Nobel Prize, which he did in 1986, for his entire body of work. Drawing on his native Yoruban as well as Western storytelling traditions and mythology, he weaves powerful dramatic and literary narratives that are aesthetically arresting and socially conscious. Mr. Soyinka's hallmark is his dramatic work, which includes Congi's Harvest, Mad Men and Specialists, The Road, and one of his most known plays, Death and the King's Horsemen. Wally Soyinka has said that his creative muse is Ogun, the Yoruban god of creativity and destruction. In his Nobel speech, Mr. Soyinka evoked this commanding deity who, at the very beginning of time, cleared a path through primordial chaos, dynamiting his way through the core of earth to open a route for his fellow deities to be reunited with us mortals. In his writing, Wally Soyinka performs a similar miracle. In works such as Poems from Prison, A Dance of the Forest, Death and the King's Horseman, and The Beautification of Area Boy, he has strut a bridge of myth and allegory to illuminate the drama and comedy of existence, reuniting humankind with the divine. During the Civil War in Nigeria, Wally Soyinka was an outspoken advocate for African democracy and justice. Arrested and accused of conspiracy in 1967, Mr. Soyinka surreptitiously wrote stories and essays on discarded cigarette packages, toilet paper, and between the lines of hidden books during his imprisonment. His clandestine writing appears in the book The Man Died, The Prison Notes of Wally Soyinka. Exiled three times and marked for death at least five different times, Soyinka has related his remarkable life in his memoirs, Ake, a chronicle of his early years, and now in a book, You Must Set Forth at Dawn, which describes his brave public and political life. It is a true honor to have him here with us tonight. Please welcome Wally Soyinka.
Thank you very much. I thought I would read you a lively section which has to do with a night ride through the forests of Nigeria into my last and I hope very final exile, because that's over. That's over now. I'll just indicate what a couple of words mean. If you encounter a sound like Oyo, know that that's just the name of a town He's saying, yes, that's the name of another town. Then there are some peculiar expressions, such as Ghana must go. Ghana must go is a kind of bag, which is very familiar in West Africa. It's used really as sometimes it's a mark of dispossession. It's used to quickly pack in all kinds of jumble. You want to adjust that? Yeah. All kinds of jumble. It holds a lot of things. Once upon a time, it held it's a jute bag used by banks to hold heavy currency notes. The use to which it's put finally indicates just how the economy of the society has dropped from carrying expensive notes, valuable notes. It now carries just jumble, so the detritus and debris of displacement. Ghana must go bags, and it's a favorite of smugglers because it holds a lot of material. Then SSS. SSS is, of course, similar to your, well, not quite CIA, but SSS is a secret services unit used for all kinds of illegal activities by the dictator. So in this passage, I finally persuaded myself that it was time to go on what I call a political sabbatical. And that took me through the jungle of certain parts of Nigeria. The irony of my night ride through the Nigerian forests would remain lost on me until much later. That is, I did not even recollect at the time that only a year and a half before, I had been forcing my way into Nigeria in a nearly equally outlandish manner, through a series of man-made obstacles that were no less determined than nature's slip, soil, gullies, boulders, and tree branches that sometimes threatened to decapitate my driver and me. I was on a motorcycle. Even a mild equivalence in the police role had not been lacking. A tense moment at embarkation when I clearly identified a man as a border agent, but not one who was cold sober and intense, and I wondered if I had left my departure till too late after all. The precautions we took had been thorough enough. Only a handful of people had been involved. So I had full confidence that our security had not been breached. The arrangements had been in place for months and only awaited my decision to activate them. False trails, improvised exits, the familiar hunting expedition that was so well known to the SSS that the code name for me was Antelope. As a matter of fact, I did find this rather troubling, if not downright unflattering. Was this all they thought of me? A game to be hunted down and eaten? Not that I was after anything glamorous. I mean, I did not aspire to any of the more lordly species, assuming that the SSS had been generous enough to have offered me a choice. After all, the name I had chosen for myself during the 1983 fight in Oyo State against an earlier fascism, that of the National Party of Nigeria, was the Modest Tracker. Still, I consoled myself that perhaps Antelope was a concession to my supposed elusiveness or my passion for hunting. If I'd hoped, however, that my namesake in the bush would learn that we were now bound together in this unsolicited naming right and lose their suspicious attitude towards me during my incursions, I was mistaken. They continued to make our encounters as meager and as frustrating as possible. For the urban denizens, I had loudly announced plans for rehearsals of the beatification of Area Boy, my latest play at the time, to keep the SSS reassured of my continued presence in the country all through December. We tied down the obvious government spy squad around my offices by having my car driven there with regularity, even when I was nowhere near the office, and maintained a semblance of normal activities through the usual stream of callers, some of whom had given up appointments. They'd been given appointments that I never meant to keep. They would understand everything soon enough. That ruse must have worked well enough since the SSS detail along Lalubu Street, that was where my private office was, continued to haunt my office dutifully for a full week after my escape, when I finally presented myself at the UNESCO headquarters in Paris for a press conference. Sonny Abacha, that's the dictator, went berserk and dismissed all the upper echelon of the immigration department at Idiroko, that's a crossing border, through which he naively imagined that I had made my escape. Yet at the departure point, the unmistakable agent had surfaced who pretended to be just one of the nocturnal crowd. When we waited for the canoe to arrive, he hung around, madly scanning my features whenever he thought I was not looking, quickly taking his eyes off when I turned my gaze at him. When a rough meal of watery beans and gari was prepared for my escort and me, famished as I was, I took one look at it, and my expression showed that I would prefer to starve until we reached the Benin side. This volunteer minder could not wait to offer to dash to a not-too-distant goods shack where he could obtain some bread and tinned pilchard sardines and even a bottle of stout. I told him factually that I did not drink stout, but that did not stop him. I told him, however, I was hungry. If he had insisted, I would have accompanied him, as I had made up my mind not to let him out of my sight for one second. The tensest moment came as we began to board the canoe after the loading of goods was done. This helpful figure of indeterminate functions took out his flashlight and began, quite unnecessarily but acceptably, to beam its light against the floor of the craft, guiding the feet of the passengers. When it came to my turn, however, he shot the beam straight in my face and kept it there. I pushed his hand down. Even with his eyes hidden by the flashlight, behind all his unctuous concern for my safety, I could see a pair of fevered eyes fastened on my face, attempting to recollect its features. Or was it simply to memorize them? I hoped it was the latter. But prepare for the worst. My hand closed around the Glock pistol I still had strapped to my waist. After that grueling ride, which had brought me just one river's width away from safety, I firmly decided that I was not about to become an actor in some weepy movie of last-minute reversals, where the fugitive, with one foot virtually on the soil of freedom, is dragged back into captivity to the wailing of violins. The sudden roar of the canoe's outboard motor drowned the sounds of the orchestra waiting in the wings, and the fisher inspector leapt back on shore. It took no more than 5 minutes, and we crossed the innocent stream that demarcated the spaces of two nations. The wharf on the Benin side, a slab of rock, was now the reverse landing point. There were a few moments to wait while the motorcycles, then the bales of merchandise, all smugglers' goods, were offloaded. I stood apart from the jostling bodies, staring across the stream, the moment of separation branding itself onto a template of infinite sadness. For one who had sworn to himself that no tyrant would ever again chase him beyond the bounds of his nation, it was a moment of bitter defeat. Even when the choice is willingly made, exile, and kind of palpable space of bereavement. At that moment, I believe that I died a little. What I tasted in my mouth was worse than ashes. I distinctly felt the crunch of cold cinders between my teeth, and it set them on edge. The river bank was a spare of cover on the Benin side, the Republic of Benin. So now that we had parted company from dense overhanging foliage, the clouds also parted to bear the landing of all subterfuge in a wash of moonlight, as if to ensure that this place of leave-taking would be deeply etched in my mind. Every detail of that moment, the solid slab of rock basalt, the bills to smuggle goods, the practiced motions of the passengers as they emptied the canoe of jute bags, outsize cartons, cylindrical portmanteau that I thought had disappeared with the advent of cheap, infinitely expandable plastic suitcases, the Ghana must go bags, sealed bills, and tied up bundles. With the casualness of practiced hands, the canoe operators piled rolls and boxes in improbable shapes across the carriers of the now offloaded motorcycles, hauled them onto the heads of waiting porters. Already, the canoe was spluttering towards the opposite bank, and the question that came to my mind was, when again? In that moment of self-pity, the line that sprang to my mind came straight from childhood, when I had made a habit of appropriating to myself those lyrical lines on the Bible that the Bible could offer. I used to recollect. Was this from the Song of Solomon or the Psalms of David? By the waters of Babylon we lay down and wept, except that I did not feel in the least like weeping. A huge wave of rage swept through and engulfed me, voiding all other emotions. Would he triumph in the end, this tyrant who had brought this upon me? Just how much was required of any individual in his lifetime? Was my life now bound together with that of a killer, albeit in absolute power, in a struggle to the death? How long would it be? How long would it take before a mangled people woke up, recovered their sense of worth, and knocked him off his pedestal into a hole so deep that generations to come would seek his remains in vain? What role would I play in this? For how long? And at what cost? The rest of my life? Would I perish in the attempt? Mercifully, there was not much time for further self-pity. All too soon, it was time to climb back on the pillion and resume the journey, riding at a more humane pace through the Benin territory. The insides of my thighs ached. There were muscles that had never been subjected to an endurance test, and I marveled yet again how the body so easily takes for granted every strand of muscle or ligament that makes it function, forgetting that some simply never come up for use in years or even decades. Even if I had been a chronic jogger, it would never have occurred to me to prepare my inner thighs for a 10-hour journey on a motorcycle pillion. 3 times I was compelled to ask my pilot to please stop while I walked up and down, improvising exercises to regain circulation and loosen up the muscles as they were repeatedly assailed by severe cramps. They ached so badly that I began to fear that I might have done permanent damage to myself. Some calamity, such as an uncontrollable muscle spasm in the future. For a hapless passenger with nothing to do except stay glued to the seat of the motorcycle, the night passage was fertile ground for the direst imaginings. In addition to 3 stops, I was thankful when we came to streams that had to be forded, or when we stopped to refuel from the spare tank, the jerrycans that were strapped to the motorcycle. I was even thankful for spills in sudden marshes or loose soil. As we rode deeper into the forest, my face was steadily lashed by branches. My driver fared even worse. He was in front. He could at least from time to time give me a warning whenever a branch loomed up around a corner, and he ducked, but mostly it was pointless. I took vicious lashes, began to wonder if the branches were exacting vengeance for the nocturnal disturbance of the peace of the forest. Well, I could hardly complain because my companion took far more whipping than I did. Occasionally, we ran into night caravans of smugglers, strung out in a line, loads of every form of merchandise on their heads, but mostly of cloth and plastic vessels, plates, bowls, and other utensils, flasks. They had obviously come up from the Lagos factories and had a steady market in Benin and Togo, neither of which, I presumed, had any such factories. Using the clandestine routes meant that they could not only avoid payment of duties, but also escape harassment of customs officers, rapacious customs officers whose exactions could prove even more onerous than the legal customs duties. But not too far off, muffled by deep vegetation, came the sound of a truck engine retreating. I guessed that the driver had taken his passengers as far as he could on a barely motorable route, then disgorged them and was returning to the collection point for the next group. It struck me again and again as absurd, the separation of peoples into artificial nations, people who, despite their external wars, nevertheless regarded one another as one of a racial kind. Now they had to brave the forests and unpredictable border patrols in order to ply their time-ordered trade, gather at festivals of reunions, and celebrate their seasonal bonds. I thought then of the people of Bobo-Dioulasso in Burkina Faso, to the northwest of Nigeria, of those annual homecomings for the obsequies of the departed that learned during my research days. That custom was only a focus for a much larger purpose, however. At that annual festival, all the people came together, both from the nation's metropolis and from beyond the borders of the nation that had once been known as Upper Volta, bringing news, retrieving relationships, and burying those who died outside the community. But now, with appropriate rites that involved weeks, even months of preparation, I wondered if I would one day be brought home, even symbolically, to rest among my own people. It was then, I now believe, as the motorcycle plunged southwards into the Republic of Benin, placing a stamp on my exile, that I formulated the last wishes for my remains, which became an obsessive catechism. If I should die outside my own borders, bury me wherever, in whatever alien land I expire in, as long as Sonny Abacha is still in charge of the nation. The thought of Bobo-Dioulasso set off all my fear, and I recoiled in horror at the prospect that the gloating feet of such a ruler should trample over the same soil that held my remains. It would later become an all-consuming dread, perhaps the only visceral fear that I nurtured throughout my years of exile. I imparted strict instructions to my family. Let no well-meaning relation ever even think of bringing my body home as long as that monstrosity holds sway over the portion of earth that I consider my own. Lost on me was the irony that only 7 years before, I had been incapable of one moment of tranquility until I had brought home the remains of my friend Femi Johnson and reinterred him in the earth of Ibadan, his choice. We set out from Oyo just before daybreak in order to hole up at Isenyi, and the motorcycle joined us for a ride that would begin before the onset of darkness. It was a routine safety precaution, but in fact, I needed a final ramble in the woods, if only as a token farewell two birds fell, and I sent them back to my friend Francis Oladele in Oyo, with whom I'd stayed briefly. Now, I wish that I'd kept one. A small fire, a rushed barbecue, bliss. Instead, nothing had passed my lips since morning. I thought briefly of the streams we had forded and dismissed them. They were not the answer to my thirst. With a prolonged privation, my mood had hardened. My concerns had undergone a drastic change. Democracy, Sani Abacha, the SSS, and the rest of the impositions of the world faded into irrelevance. The moment that the motorcycle wheels began to churn deeper into the Republic of Benin, with the bush track yielding to a motorable, though still untarred, stretch of road, all my worldly and spiritual concerns coalesced into a marvelous simplicity, a reduction to the basic essentials that were projected onto two events and two events only. The shimmer behind eyelids that were caked and with squashed moths, another winged life of the night, racking me with anticipation. One was a long, cold shower. Next, a long, cold beer. For both, at that moment, I was prepared to batter even my cactus patch, that's my designated Rio Grande. My throat was caked with dust. I felt I could taste pollen, bugs, and grime all the way down into the remotest coils of my intestines. The prospect of the materialization of those two events took on an agonizing intensity. After a ride of another 2 hours, the lights of human habitations replaced the swarms of fireflies that sometimes turned the bushes into a fantasy grove, suggesting possible sources of inspiration for Fagunwa's Ogbojuode Enu Igbo Iwumale. It's a novel by a Yoruba classicist. I felt my tongue rattle in the dried gulch that passed for the caverns of my mouth, and I swallowed hard in the agony of expectation. The sparse lines of electric poles meant only one thing, beer. Unrefrigerated. I began to look out for familiar signs that would indicate the watering holes of the inhabitants of that region of Benin. The lamps on the tubular poles were virtually transformed into advertising beacons for that single commodity, a supremely chilled beer. I understood for the first time the essence of mirages, since from time to time I could swear that I saw a sweaty beer bottle thrust itself out of a billboard and reach out towards me, cold to the touch, only to melt away again into the dark surrounding of the pool of illumination provided by the motorcycle lamp. Then, in a reversal of normal expectations, instead of the lighted road lamps becoming more and more frequent as we approached the township, they stopped abruptly, even though the poles retained their precisely spaced levitations from the dark, and their lamps, unlit, were visible in the moonlight. When we entered Charuo, the border town, next to a point of incursion, only the moon provided any glimmering of light. Then I observed that there were no lights visible in the houses, not even in the town center, which, to make matters worse, appeared completely deserted. It was not long past midnight, so what kind of a town was this? Clearly not a rural habitation, yet the inhabitants appeared to have retired with the poultry. It turned out that most inopportunely, we had timed our arrival for the Oro Festival of Chauru. No light was permitted in the streets. All lights were extinguished, and even a cigarette could be lit. Not even a cigarette could be lit out of doors, and women, in particular, could not be seen. It also meant, of course, that the late night bars were closed. My guide could not have been more disconsolate. As he returned from conversing with a cluster of men who sat on their porch, speaking in low voices. He soon grew cheerful, however, and assured me that this situation would be remedied somehow once he was safely within the compound of his uncle. It also meant having to find the uncle's home with his lamp switched off. This was no simple task. Our destination proved to be a kind of way station for smugglers of both night and day, who had good means to evade encounters with customs officers and the police. The house was just outside the township itself and could be approached only by two-wheelers such as ours. Threading our way towards it between the warren of houses was no different. It struck me from swerving around natural obstacles in the forests, except that here there were recumbent goats and sheep, upturned cooking pots and pails, stacks of firewood, open hearths, pestles and mortars propped against walls in narrow passages, even water wells. All had to be carefully negotiated. Fortunately, the moonlight was generous. We made it safely, my pilot stopping to speak to two or three of the locals and deliver messages. When we arrived at the household of his uncle, the welcome was spontaneous, but also instinctively wary, marked by curiosity. Even in my disheveled condition, I stood out completely as an obvious stranger. Eyes followed me, but no questions were asked. Perhaps my pilot operated by telepathy, or the whispered instructions he had heard earlier had involved couriers racing ahead through hidden passages, for unknown to me, a miracle lay in wait. I had barely time to note that the uncle in whose home I had been billeted had his radio tuned in to news from Nigeria when, courtesies over, he pointed to a seat, then waved towards a low table. Standing in splendor on that table was that which I had spotted from the moment I entered the room, but from which I had stolidly turned my gaze, fearful that a sudden visual assault might make it vanish. But yes, it was indeed a bottle of beer, moist and cold to the touch, the loveliest object that fugitive humanity could ever hope to set eyes upon. In a moment, its existential mission was fulfilled. It sat, depleted but transfigured, in the effusiveness of my gratitude. Next came the other half of the unspoken covenant. A crude shed in the open yard, with only a token cover to shield its user from passing eyes, within it stood a bucket of water. I threw all inhibition to the winds, peeled off my clothes, and began to scrub the dust, grime, and squash flies off my body. And my hair received a rare soapy cleansing. It had become a haven for every species of bug and moth that ever caused the night paths of the tropical forest, my hat having flown off early in the ride. When I was hardly done, my ears picked up a long, forgotten sound that suddenly violated the calm of the night. Oro Festival. It said it all. I could have been in Ishara, my paternal village, within an identical warren of mud houses that are so familiar in a typical Yoruba town. Even the red-baked earth with its mild contortions and undulations mimicked Ishara. When the masquerade arrived, it went from house to house, decanting blessings and receiving tokens of the people's gratitude. I remained outside, beside the door, in the shadow cast by the roof of the house, under the strong moon, watching this denizen of the spirit world flit from house to house, vanish within, emerge a few moments later with his retinue. Aroused around us, retreating and advancing, was the whine of the bull roarer. Seated on the ground, my legs stretched full length, I rested my strained back against the wall of my dwelling for the night. shirtless, basking in the night of Oru, that the firmament appeared to honor with such a vast, luminous sky. Or perhaps it was the otherworldly Oru that chose to call human attention to the splendor of the night by ordering all terrestrial lights extinguished. Certainly, and how could it be otherwise to a voyager who had just survived the hostility of the night forest? It seemed to me that I had never known a night so deep, so eternal and serene. All rage was gone. All physical pain subsided. I chuckled to myself as I recalled the moment of panic, now remote and unreal, when I had thought that the busybody at the departure point had no other mission in life but to haul me back into Abacha's insatiable maw. My sense of peace was like a velvet cape that floated down to cover my semi-nudity. I could not stem a wave of nostalgia for what I had known, longing for what could be, lamenting how simple life really was. A cold shower, a cold beer, and then an ancestral presence that roamed the night to touch a people deep down within the secretive space where the communal soul resides. As Oro spirit mask whirled gradually in my direction, it was a most unnerving moment because a microsecond before I'd happened to look down to my right side, my eye caught by a twin spot that was boldly reflecting the moonlight, glowing so brightly that I thought a pair of fireflies had settled on my skin. I saw what it was, and I was deeply embarrassed. Had I broken the taboo? For they turned out to be the luminous beat of the Glock. I had retained this incongruous object next to my skin throughout the journey for self-protection. It had become such a part of my attire for so many months that I had come to feel undressed without it. And thus, after my shower, even here, I had routinely restored it to its place beneath my waistband. I snatched at it, yanked it out, stuck it under my buttocks. I was in the shade of the roof, however, and no one appeared to have noticed anything unusual. The masquerade procession moved to accept me into a community into whose bosom I had been thrust so unceremoniously. Oro spun round and round before me while I watched listlessly. One of the attendants offered me a kola nut over which Oro had whispered some incantation. It was also familiar, albeit so infrequent, a manifestation. With only a variation here and there, this was a scene that tended to insinuate itself unbidden into telling moments of my existence. I took the kola nut and bit into it. Oro chanted what were clearly prayers in a low voice, as one who communed with intimate forces. Silently, spontaneously, I muttered mine along his own. It was a deep, heartfelt, impossible craving. I prayed that the peace of this night, this pool of infinite solace, might endure forever. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Shoyanka will be treating to beer at the Rose Tattoo after our discussion tonight. If you could, the way this works here is that if you would hold up your hand, I will call on you. Please wait for the microphone, and we'll get it to you. Are there any questions to start us off? All the way in back in the center, Miriam, all the way in back there. If you could keep your hand up, please. Further back? Thanks.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library of Philadelphia. Given the worldwide appeal of your books, I'm interested in what portion of your books are sold in Africa, what portion are sold in Europe, and what portion are sold in America, and whether that percentage varies depending upon the type of book you're writing.
I'm afraid I'm not very good at statistics. But I know that my in Nigeria, I do receive a reasonable royalty annually from my, in fact, from my three publishers, OUP, Spectrum, and what's the name of the other book, Bankole Olaibi's books. And so I think a fair amount gets sold, but then people also exchange lots of books. Books are rather expensive, and I imagine that one copy of a book will serve, you know, an average of three or four people, students or whatever. So I really can't give you figures. I'm not really good at carrying figures in my head.
Another question? All the way in back on this side. Trudy, if you'd keep your hand up.
When he came to power, it seemed that President Obasanjo might be the antidote to the era of dictators like Sani Abacha. I wonder if you could talk about where you see Nigeria now, what you think of the prospects that President Obasanjo might stay on past his two constitutional terms, and where you think Nigeria is headed in the next few years. Will it stay together? Will its oil ever be a blessing?
Yes, first of all, I'm always very happy to encounter that question, because it means that people here are taking an interest in what's happening in Nigeria. And Nigeria is too important, too pivotal nation within the continent to be ignored. What happens there really affects many other parts of the continent. And Obasanjo would really have made, as many of us thought, an excellent transitional ruler. In fact, the program which the opposition had after getting rid of the military called for an interim government of national unity and then a sovereign national conference by the people to determine for the first time in full freedom just how they wanted to decide their own future. And for that bridge, for that period, interim period, which we felt should not be more than a year or two, it seemed quite logical that a former military ruler who had given up power according to schedule, handed over to civilian regime, and one who, having ruled before, had tasted the other side of life. He was imprisoned, as you know, by Sani Abacha, so he knew what tyranny was, what misuse of power was. And he was saved, literally, by, you know, from the firing squad by sheer whiskers. So somebody like that certainly would make an ideal bridge between a military legacy and a forthcoming, an oncoming democracy. However, those who rigged him into office didn't believe in a temporary interim government of national unity. They wanted to go straight for quote-unquote democracy, and so elections were held and he was catapulted back into power. And before too long, I think Nigerians began to learn that you can take a man out of the military, but you cannot take the military out of the man, especially in societies such as ours. Well, the first 4 years, these were watchful years, waiting, trying to see whether he needed more than 4 years to undo the severe damage to national psyche, economy, ethics, sheer functioning infrastructure on many levels. You know all about epileptic electric power, still going until today. Hopeful that the first 4 years, okay, we'll take it as the interim period. The next elections were rigged, this time by him, not by his handlers, not by his minders, heavily and contemptuously, insultingly rigged. And now, on top of that new stolen mandate, as you said, he's trying to subvert the constitution so as to stay on in power. We're back in short, to where we started. Strong-arm tactics, misuse of the SSS, the secret services, the uniformed police, bribery, coercion, bullying, blackmail, misuse of the oil revenue. He's been Minister of Petroleum ever since he became president, in spite of both houses ordering him to appoint a Minister of Petroleum. No, he handles that ministry himself. And Nigeria, as you know, is a mono-product kind of economy. So somebody who sits on that with absolute powers holds enormous economic resources to bribe and twist the situation as it pleases. So that's what Nigeria is experiencing right now. It's a pity that what should be a source of transformation, the oil, has been used really for the consolidation of power throughout our experience since the discovery of oil. And of course, the restlessness in the oil-producing region has multiplied, has increased, you know, about the taking of hostages, you know, blowing up of oil pipes. There's a level of discontent at the moment which has been manifested in increasingly militant fashion, and it's very difficult to predict where the nation might go. One thing which the majority of the nation is determined upon is that this subversion of the Constitution for the prolongation of Obasanjo's stay will not happen. It'll be a tough fight, but that fight has already begun, and we'll just wait and see what it results in.
Another question right here in front.
Are you personally in any danger about going back to Nigeria because of your opposition to the current status of the government?
Well, you understand, of course, that I am back in Nigeria. Oh, yes, I've been back a number of years. You know, I began with half a leg, then one leg. Now I think I have about one and a half legs in Nigeria, and I hope to pull up the remaining half before too long. So I came back from Nigeria just a few weeks ago. I'm going back again in a couple of weeks, and I'm part and parcel, an active part of the movement going on to present a people's constitution to the people, as opposed to the present military, over-centralized and iniquitous constitution which we're running. So I'm there. And as far as danger is concerned, yes, some people think I am. Urge me to be careful and so on. But the danger is a tolerable one. It's not like during the period of Abacha. I can walk the streets, I can speak my mind, and I do. And I can even call the president my friend, even if I think he wants to stab me in the back. So it's a very different kind of risk, quite acceptable.
Next question. This gentleman right here with his hand up.
Professor Soyinka, 30 years ago at the FESTAC Festival, 1977 to be exact, you gave a speech in which you suggested Pan-African language, Swahili, to be a language that should be taught to all kids from elementary up to high school. It's 30 years now, about 30 years, and I was wondering if your position has changed or it is still remain the same.
Well, my position has not changed, and of course the objective validity of that proposal has been accepted by several institutions, the African Union of Teachers, the Organization of African Unity, which has now become the AU. Swahili is being taught, the language is being enriched in East Africa by the Institute for Kiswahili. But in terms of the practical application along the lines which we propose at FESTAC, I'm afraid the situation is still very much the way it was. The reasons are not too far to seek. Leaders are so busy with the, you know, staying in power, rifling the economy, that notions like this, you know, tend to take the back seat. But it's still there. It's still on the drawing board.
Lady right here in the striped shirt.
Are you familiar with Chris Abani? Chris Abani.
It's about an ears.
Yes. Okay. He too was imprisoned for writing. How does the government find you? Does the government in Nigeria have book readers who check every book that's written to see if there are conspiracies against the government? Does someone read your work and then report to the government that this is suspicious, that it's in opposition to the government programs? How does it come about that you are imprisoned because of what you've written?
The original title of my memoirs was actually Beyond the Word. And that was intended to indicate that writers do more than just write. And the government very often has its hands so full of those who actually go beyond the word that I don't think they do much more reading. They map down columnists and journalists, in fact, at greater risk than writers in the, you know, the sense in which we use the word in an environment like this. Many journalists in Nigeria were imprisoned, tortured. Sometimes their families were taken hostage, children. Pictures, amazing pictures of the SSS breaking into homes, pointing a gun to a child's head and screaming at him, "Where's your father? Where's your father?" A writer who also uses the media is more likely to gain the attention of the rulers, the dictators, than those who stick to works within bound covers. Many of them don't read anyway; they can't illiterate. But then you also have those snoopers who indicate to the powers that be that this writer is inserting certain subversive messages in this book. I mean, if you remember, what we learned during the fatwa against Salman Rushdie was that the Ayatollah never even read the book, the Satanic Verses. Yep, never read it. It was simply the assiduous acolytes of faith who reported to him that somebody had transgressed against Islamic religion. So people don't need to read books when they're in power. They just lash out.
Next question. Gentleman in the hat all the way back there. Miriam, nope. Behind you? Yes.
In view of the situation that you have described in Nigeria, the hopelessness that you have described for us, and that some of us who are actually Nigerians are aware of, what do you think? Do you think there's a possibility that Nigeria might break up? And if so, will you support, you know, the emergence of an Oduwa nation? Because I know you are Yoruba, you know, son. So will you support that kind of development?
Let me state my personal preference. My preference is that the nation does not break up. My reasons may be selfish, maybe because I travel so much, and I'm tired of collecting visas inside my passport. So from a purely practical point of view, I'd be quite happy to travel within Nigeria without having to apply for so many other visas to visit my friends elsewhere. Also, there's a richness about Nigeria which is unique for many African nations, and the idea that you can go into one national space and go through so many traverse so many cultures and so on is a plus for any nation. However, I have always held the view that the lives of human beings are not worth the mythology of oneness, because oneness can be a mythology. If it's a fake, if the peoples who occupy a nation space are not one, then you're trying to preserve a myth. And I don't believe that myths should be preserved at the expense of humanity, the disruption of life, of day-to-day existence, a sense of security. And you're creating a nation out of coercion. It's one of the reasons why I considered the civil war to have been an unethical war, because people who had been savaged badly, the Igbo, the Biafrans, were now subjected to the massive military might of the federal government, which had failed to protect them. What the scenario will be in a few years is very difficult to tell at this point. But I foresee the possibility of a breakup if Obasanjo persists in awarding himself a third term. I know that some very strong sections of the nation are determined to pull the roof of the nation down over everybody's head if that scenario is actualized. So the man who keeps saying the sovereignty of Nigeria is non-negotiable may end up, ironically, being the one who absolutely batters away the sovereignty of the nation. In the national conference, which you know about, Sovereign National Conference, which is actually going on right now, we're broken into committees. One of the first things we underlined was that, unlike Obasanjo's conference, there will be no no-go area. Anybody is free to come up and say that, look, Nigeria is too big, Nigeria is impossible, in any case, we want to go away. That right of speech we have absolutely guaranteed in during the conference. One of the problems with Obasanjo's confab is, Obasanjo, by the way, when the people got together to say, look, let the people in freedom, the civil society, let the people in freedom decide what kind of constitution they want. So Obasanjo very quickly organized his own confab. He called it Political Reforms Conference, and quickly tinkered with the constitution, of course, to one purpose only, to allow himself an extended term. But what they kept emphasizing was that there were certain no-go areas, and one no-go area was even any discussion whatsoever of the possibility of Nigeria breaking up. But if people come with the proposal that it's best for Nigeria to break up, then it's up to the rest of us to persuade them of stronger reasons why Nigeria should not break up. And not only that, to initiate certain processes that will make remaining within Nigeria not just a viable, but a profitable prospect for everybody. At the moment, that is not being done. That's why the militancy in the oil-producing area is so strong and so determined and gets more and more intransigent every day. So I'm not a prophet. All I can say is that that country is being run in a way at the moment which actually guarantees an eventual breakup.
We have time for one more question. Gentleman with his hand up about three quarters of the way back with the beard. Keep your hand up, please.
Thank you. First, I want to thank you for all you've contributed and achieved in general, and specifically to me for imprinting in my mind the phrase, woman is the dome of creation, 30 years ago. I still contemplate that from time to time. I was in Nigeria in 1974 to 77, living mostly in the north, and at that time it seemed the form of Islam there was relatively benign. Now it appears there are currents that are possibly very destructive and reactionary. To what extent is that a complicating factor in Nigeria's future, and to what extent can the problem that presents be bridged or solved or attacked?
Yes, actually, that question reminds me of a certain aspect of the question asked by my compatriot there. If you remember, the Sharia form of government was established first by a state called Zamfara. And after that, it became a kind of snowballing effect. And I think at the moment, there are nine states in Nigeria which are governed by the Sharia. Now, the Sharia, the Islamic law, by the way, is actually entrenched and permitted in the constitution. But within certain limits, there are certain areas over which theocratic laws have absolutely or traditional laws have absolutely no jurisdiction, no authority. And what those states did were to unilaterally write a new constitution for themselves. And my statement at the time still holds. I consider those states to have seceded. Because Nigeria is not a theocratic state. There is a kind of aggressiveness, undeniable aggressiveness going on by the fundamentalists of, in particular, Islamic religion. We witnessed more killings, religious sectarian killings in the last decade than that nation has known throughout its post-independence era. The disease, the virus of intolerance, of bigotry, of sheer fundamentalist insanity, which is course in the world, could not fail to affect Nigeria. So what is happening in Nigeria today is really what we're witnessing all over the world. Nigeria cannot hope to be an exception. And unfortunately, a lack of nerve in the regime at a critical moment was what made the extremists of this religion get away with the initial gambit and ask for more, like Oliver Twist. And that's what's going on right now, you know. Just ask for more, take more. It's the story of the camel and the camel owner all over again. The camel said, can I, you know, camel is tethered outside the tent, says it's cold outside, can I just put one leg in? And the owner said, all right, I want to be humane, you know, bring your leg in. The next woman, can I put my hump in? Can I put in the other hump? And can I put in my head? And eventually, the camel gave him a kick right through the roof of his tent. And that, I'm afraid, is what happens to extremist demands of any kind, ideological extremism, theocratic extremism, of any nature whatsoever. What we're seeing here is a part trying to dictate to the whole. So what will happen, I don't know, but one of the things we discussed at this conference, in fact, one of the protocols which we insist upon, is that Nigeria must remain a secular state. I certainly don't wish to live in a theocratic state. I don't want to travel from one part of the country to another and find that certain actions which are permitted in one section are criminalized in another. I don't want to live in a state where anybody works whatever he or she believes, that's their business. But to practice stoning a woman to death, burying a woman up to the neck and stoning her to death for any religious consideration, when this was not how we came together as an independent nation, I find it totally unacceptable under whatever grounds. If you want to rewrite the rules of our existing together as one entity, then I recommend that it's about time we think seriously of my remedy, that we apply to NASA, and when the next launch is being put them all inside the rocket and let them go and found another land somewhere else. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.